know, invest in alternative investments, because people are getting screwed with all these retail stock market investments and they don't even know it. I mean, look at my parents. They invested in that stuff their entire lives and they barely got them anywhere. And yeah, you know, I get it. That's how Wall Street works. Wall Street, you know, how else do they have these large, big buildings? Mostly all the CEOs in the building, you know, all the profits go to them.
Welcome to Lessons in Leverage, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of success. We'll help you unlock the secrets of leverage so you can amplify your impact in the world. Here's your host, Spencer Lowe.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons in Leverage. I'm excited today to be joined by Lane. Is it Kawaoka? I didn't ask your last name.
You got it, man. Got it. First goal.
All right. Perfect. Lane owns 4,000 plus units and is responsible for finding investment opportunities, analysis, and marketing. He is an expert that started his career first in industrial engineering and civil engineering and construction management, and then moved over into real estate and was able to acquire quite a bit of leverage on that side. He has real world experience working as a project manager for over $230 million of capital construction projects in the public and private sector. He worked as a high paid professional in corporate America. And then after he got frustrated by the traditional wealth building dogma, Lane was compelled to inspire and mentor other working professionals via his podcast, The Wealth Elevator. So very excited to have you on, podcast host, real estate professional, and really a perfect fit for us of someone who went from kind of a pretty normal path into a much higher leverage set of opportunities. So thanks for being here, Lane.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Aloha, everybody.
So tell me a little bit about your upbringing, Lane. I want to go back first and you know, no one ends up at going to college and getting into a very typical engineering job without some influence. Was that kind of the path your parents set out for you? Talk to me what it was like growing up in Hawaii and deciding on the original career path.
Yeah, I mean, my parents, I mean, we're Japanese Americans. I'm like the fourth generation. So, you know, my parents, you know, they were all about that jam of going to college. You know, they themselves went to college and, you know, I guess that's what I was supposed to do, right? And buy a house to live in, have 2.1 kids and, you know, invest in the 401k and all that stuff. So, you know, growing up, we're taught to be pretty frugal with our money. You know, luckily, I kind of had good financial skills. You know, don't buy stuff I can't afford. You know, some of the clients today, they kind of start out, they don't have that, right? But, you know, I was kind of lucky enough to kind of start off with good financial skills, like I said. And then, you know, I mean, I was working job. My first job was like picking pineapples in Maui. I think I made a couple grand that year. And where did it go? But my Roth IRA is like a 13-year-old.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I call this the linear path, right? That a lot of people find themselves on, you know, we're kind of forced to, you know, you study hard, get into, you know, do extracurricular activities, get into a good college, you know, you're there for a few years and, you know, hopefully you have some fun because then you go into corporate America where I did work, started working for a Fortune 50 company and I hated it. You know, was this what it was all about? You know, I got that engineering degree and started to work for the man. And, you know, luckily I had a good salary, right? You know, almost six figures back in, that was what, 2007. And again, compelled on this linear path or autopilot, I'm sure you guys talk about this all the time, you know, buying a house to live in. And that's what I did. I saved up, I think, 80 grand from 2007 to 2009 from my day job to put down on a down payment on a house because that's what we're all programmed to do, you know, and maybe, I mean, we can get into it too. I don't necessarily think buying a house to live in is, you know, a good idea for some people out there, but that's what I did. Because I was brainwashed from the start. And my path took a pivot when, you know, I was traveling all over for work, right? I was a construction supervisor managing a crew of guys. And we would travel, you know, from state to state. And I was only home on like Saturdays. And, you know, young mid-20-year-old kid, I was like, this is kind of silly to have this, you know, cool house to myself where I get to enjoy it on Saturday. You know, hell, why don't I just start to rent it out, right? Kind of like you know, this is well before Turl, the days of Turl, right? At Airbnb. So that's what I did. And that was the aha moment. I was like, wait a minute. Like, these guys are paying me. I think the mortgage was $1,600 and my rents was like $2,200, $2,300. And I knew nothing about the, you know, the 50% rule, one rent to value ratios or like CapEx expenses. But like, for our young kid who, you know, never saw rental real estate, you know, working, I was like, wow, this is a lot of beer money I'm making. And that was the start, man. That was like when I peeked behind the curtain and I realized the Wizard of Oz wasn't real. And I kind of uncovered this world of rental real estate where you're making the money through cash flow, appreciation, tax benefits. And, you know, the fact that the tenants paying down your mortgage for you with their heart, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story. So thanks for sharing that. I mean, that's, I think a lot of people do start out kind of from even a position worse off than you did. You know, at least you came up with some financial education. Parents were teaching you some good values and some good basic principles. And so a lot of people, you know, I think come up in families where it's just sort of make money and spend it as fast as I can. You know, a lot of people I talk to have no concept of anything that would be productive long term, let alone doing something beyond a normal job. And so, you know, I love the way that you had that realization, first of all, of everything I've learned up to now has been useful, but now that I'm in this job, is this really the long-term future? I think that is a common point for everyone. And it sometimes it happens earlier in life, sometimes it happens way later in life, but I think people sometimes need to get dissatisfied a little bit and a little disenchanted in order to kind of get the motivation to reassess. And hey, good for people that never get disenchanted and love their life. I mean, that's the real goal. The real goal is to have a really fulfilling life. And so if you find that, good for you. But I think when people are missing that, they start to wonder, you know, is there other paths? And so when you first took that step of renting out your house, I'm sure that there were some assumptions and some either fears or excitement. Talk to me a little bit about what you went through, because you're still working your job at this time and you're saying, all right, I'm not using my house that much. First of all, walk me through the logistics. Did you decide to rent? Was this like, I'm going to move into an apartment and rent on my where I'm going to live so that I can rent out my house? Did you like house hack and rent part of the house? Tell me the logistics of how you kind of rationalized that as someone who had no background and was taking that step.
Well, I mean, this is a little bit unique. I think not everybody can do this. I mean, I was in hotels, like I said, 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. And I had the ability to just stay where I was at throughout the weekend. So I could pretty much vagabond 100% of the time. So I could remember that weekend. I mean, you know, going back to what you said earlier, right? Like, if there's a pain point, that's when amazing things happen, right? You make changes. I can remember being in like Idaho, northern Idaho, and going over to Montana, which sucked, right? I was in pain. I was like, and I was toiling on this idea for a few weeks, right? Like, I didn't know anything about like renting my place out. Apparently you just get a property manager, you know, which I called the old one. That was kind of the first actionable step I took. But I can remember sitting there like in the middle of freaking nowhere and like, my God, I'm gonna have to do this for 30, 40 years. I don't wanna do that. Like, I gotta do something else. So that was kind of where the motivation came to get off the beaten path and do something a little bit different. And I just, you know, I can remember, like I said, I called an old property manager up, which is all you really need to, you know, especially if you're a passive investor, get a property manager to rent your place out. You know, they take 10% of your rents, but, you know, they pretty much do everything. Great for like a, you know, newbie, a landlord like myself. But I drove all the way from like, I was in Whitefish, Montana, all the way to Seattle, Washington, where I was at. I think it must have took more than 12 hours for sure. I got back and I just started to like sell stuff on Craigslist like crazy. Of course, I'm smart. I lined it up several days before, but like the next morning, everybody came. I sold my stuff. I was throwing my mattress all to the third floor. You know, I'm going to sell that. In a matter of a day, like 90% of my crap was gone. The rest I put into a self-storage facility and... yeah, I was homeless, apparently.
Oh, I want to sit on this for just a second, because there's a couple of lessons I think the audience really should pay attention to. One is, this idea that you actually created leverage with your current employer. And this is another commonality I've seen talking to a lot of entrepreneurs pre-making the jump. There's often these little ways they find leverage in the current system that then open up, creating a lot more leverage outside of the system. So the fact that your current employer was paying for hotels for you, that's a massive source of leverage. A lot of people look at a traveling job. It's like, oh, that sucks. You always have to be away. But in your case, that ended up being a huge hack, essentially, to say, great, this is going to open up a door to me to not need a full-time home, rent this out, and start to build on that success from there. And obviously, you know, we'll get to it, but that led to you not having to have that job anymore. But there's often these opportunities, like a friend that I interviewed for the podcast found that in the military. There's things where it's like, military doesn't pay well, has a lot of downsides. But then there's all these upsides that he was able to leverage to build his business outside of that. So I love that part. Find leverage where you're at. Find these little opportunities that can start to have a long-term impact. And then the second piece that I wanted to notice is there's a massive shift that just happened there, which was you were a common trait of the common path is consumerism. So it's let me acquire stuff. It's not just have the house, not just build the family, not just sort of the more stereotypical things. It's also buy stuff. You need to just buy stuff. And so you acquire all this stuff. And now since I have stuff, I have to spend more money on more places to put it. And then I get trapped, and then I have more bills. So I can't start a business because how will I ever pay all my bills? And so the system reinforces these things that further burden you and make you feel trapped. And so there's a massive freedom in saying, look, I actually don't need most of this stuff. I'm going to sell it. I'm going to get actually money for it. Maybe not what I paid for it. Maybe it would have been better never to buy it in the first place, but I'm going to liquidate this stuff. People forget they can do that. They like have a house full of stuff and they just assume they have to keep it. So you liquidate it. You create massive flexibility so you don't need that house anymore. And just like that, you are a landlord. You went from employee to landlord overnight. I love that.
Yeah. And from a high level, and you know, when we work with clients more on the financial side and, you know, kind of building these plans together. But essentially what I did was before that point, I was saving maybe 30 grand a year, you know, from my day job. But I went from that point to saving, you know, I didn't have to pay rent, mortgage anymore. I didn't have all this crap. I kind of took that money and could invest it. Like I probably was able to save six figures a year.
Wow.
And that was the, you know, the leverage I think that I created that eventually I would keep buying more and more rental properties. And for like 3 to 5 years of plowing away six figures into investments, you know, that's going to pay off at some point, right?
It will. Yeah, and especially early on in your career, that has such a compounding effect for the long-term outcomes. And people underestimate that. You know, the reality is that you have to have a bigger vision in order to have the motivation to do that. If you're just trying to impress your friends and get the stuff to look impressive, then you're going to do that. And your money's going to be gone. You're going to wonder, man, why don't I have any long-term stability? Why don't I have what someone else has? People look at the result after 3-4 years. And it's easy to see, but they often don't see behind the curtain. All right, Lane had to actually put away six figures a year, had to save the majority of what he was making. And so there is great value. This is one area that even though I disagree with like the Dave Ramsey's of the world on plenty of things, it's one, they do start with a fundamental thing that a lot of people don't have. And that is you got to learn to save. You have to learn to control your costs and save to get to the point where you can spend. There's a process of becoming. You can't pretend you're rich before you're rich. So If you're trying so hard to look rich that you never get there, it's going to be a shame. And so you have to take the money and save it. Now, what you do with it when it's saved is maybe another question. But certainly, if you don't have any money to invest, you're never going to have a home, never going to have a rental property, never going to have any of that stuff. So another, I think, important takeaway for people. Sometimes they hear about tactics and they hear about people that did something really quickly and they miss that step of it takes some sacrifice and some effort, certainly in that domain.
Yeah. And you kind of mentioned Dave Ramsey. Like, I'm not an anti-Dave Ramsey guy. Like, and like the new book that's coming out next month is called The Wealth Elevator. The whole idea behind it is that there's different floors to this financial journey. Now, Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman, these guys, they kind of, I think a lot of financial advice out there is predicated to people on what we call the basement floor. Sounds horrible, I know. But it is the starting point, right? Like, most people out there are pretty horrible with their money. They, number one, don't make over 50, 60 grand a year, and they spend more than they make. Like I have a lot of gratitude for it, but I started on the first floor of the wealth elevator, right? I had good financial skills. I had a good paying job. you know, it's more about like what we do with myself and my clients is how can we take you going from 45 miles an hour and take you to 85 and then over 100, right? That's kind of the leverage that we want to kind of create for people. But it's confusing, right? Because like you have, you know, Dave Ramsey seems like a great guy, right? It's not that the strategies are bad. It's just different places for different times. You know, the same thing, like you're not going to tell your little nephew who's 4 year old that, you know, to go and cross the street. But a grown adult, you tell them something very different. In the financial world, nobody's been able to curate content for like more accredited investors, high net worth investors, people who are already kind of moving along that line.
Yeah, it's such an important point distinction. You know, I think one of the things I hear a lot on social media is like, here's five tricks the wealthy don't want you to know, or here's the secret of the wealthy. And I'm like, okay, first of all, I know a lot of wealthy people. None of them are give a crap about if people know certain
things. They're not launching it.
They're not their thing. Yes, but second of all, what they're doing doesn't always apply to you for that exact reason. You know, I'm not modeling my financial strategies after Jeff Bezos because Jeff Bezos has a multi-hundred billion net worth, and I do not. So we're not going to be doing the exact same things. There's times where certain patterns and principles are applicable. That's great. There's also times where it's the exact wrong thing. It's kind of like scaling a business. One of the interesting dichotomies of entrepreneurship is what you need early on in entrepreneurship is the exact opposite skill set of what you need to scale the business. That's why so many small businesses get acquired by private equity and they put in an experienced management team and they scale the business because they know that the entrepreneur that built it, if they aren't self-aware and they don't learn what it takes to turn that corner, then the exact things that got them there are what's going to hold them back from going where they need to go. And so there's a massive arbitrage in that of here's this asset that's sort of peaked at what it's going to be with this leader. And now if we just buy it and swap leaders, we're going to take it to 10x that. And so watching that happen is very similar to what happens in finances. If you only ever got a basement level financial education, you're never going to find yourself on the first floor. If you never got that first floor education, you're going to find it hard to get to that second floor. And wherever you're at in that journey, the advice is probably different, sometimes conflicting. And it's important to have that context because, you know, you can't just follow what, oh, well, my dad does this. Well, your dad might be in a totally different place. Or you know, I learned this as a kid. Well, you're older, you have different. And I've even struggled with that. You know, when I had principles that were working really well for me. And then I got to a certain point of wealth where I realized, oh man, this is a whole new set of rules. And I got to learn a whole new set of practices and principles. And so I think everybody's going to go through that. So I love the way you frame that to understand, am I getting the right advice, right time? If you do the right thing at the wrong time, it'll blow up, you know? And so you got to do the right thing at the right time.
So kind of getting back to my story, you know, I had that first rental property and then I bought a couple other units in Seattle. Eventually heard about these turnkey rentals and, you know, more flyover states like Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis. Fast forward to 2015, I had 11 of these rental properties. Thought I was doing pretty damn good, right? Probably was, right? For a guy in his late 20s. But then I found other accredited investors to learn from. And accredited investors are guys $1 million net worth or greater. And they certainly were a little bit older than myself. And what I discovered is a lot of these guys would trade in their little rental properties because rental properties are a great way to get started as we're kind of discussing the whole paradigm. Right, I was kind of transitioning more into the next floor, the wealth elevator or accredited investor paradigm, and you know, going into more syndications and private placements, you know, that utilize cost segregations, bonus depreciation to now get access to even better tax strategies at below 401ks, Roth IRAs out of the water, and then you know, then I kind of found myself on the next like floor, right, to use a better word. And this is kind of a point where, you know, this was kind of where I think, you know, you were kind of asking like points along the journey that I kind of stepped from being a passive investor. Like up until this point, I was working my engineering job because I had a good amount of money and kind of had that. I was progressing pretty well on the financial freedom path. My career path, I could care less about, right? Like I was not a very good engineer. So I started to, you know, change jobs and, you know, and got out of private where it's higher paid, more stress, and started work for the government, you know, and that probably would have been a good lifestyle for me to kind of rock on my nuts for the next, decade or two. But I started to jump into the more entrepreneurship side. In 2016, I started my podcast, The Wealth Elevator. And, you know, back then, not a lot of people were starting podcasts and didn't really have an authentic voice. I don't know. Apparently, people like it, right? Because I tell people like what I do and the mistakes I made, and it, you know, got some traction, right? Traction's important.
Absolutely.
And, you know, started this investment company and investment education group and community. And that was kind of where I realized, you know, it's probably a little irresponsible for me to go to work, do like 1 hour work, and then have my laptop where I do my real estate entrepreneurship on the side, you know, editing podcasts and stuff like that. So that was the point where I kind of got off of that linear path. And again, I look back and a lot of that was luck, right? Like without the Wealth Elevator podcast getting traction, which is entirely luck, you know, I wouldn't have kind of gotten off that beaten path. Would have had a great life. You know, probably would have had several $1 million net worth by the time I was 35, 40. But yeah, that was, I realized that there was an opportunity there and I needed to, you know, live out the destiny. Maybe it was kind of what I thought.
Tell me more about that. So what was it that the podcast changed for you? Was it sort of getting to a certain point of notoriety and thus having an audience big enough that it started to monetize? And so that gave you some more comfort in terms of where your income was going to come from. I mean, it sounds like you had 11 properties at the time. Was that not a significant enough source of cash flow for you to feel comfortable with that? Talk me through kind of the mechanics of why that was the catalyzing moment.
Yeah. So on the investing side, right, this is more the personal side. The 11 rentals, I sold all those things because they're a pain in the butt and they're not very, they don't utilize value add strategies, right? You can't, you don't make as much money doing that stuff. And I transferred it all into syndications and private placements. And then
syndications, where you were the syndicator, where you started a syndication or where you were involved in other people's
syndicates? A little bit of both. And in both cases, you know, this is what's hard for new investors getting into the syndication world. You get stuck with all these like really inexperienced operators under $1 billion of assets owned. And it's a fake it till you make it game. And like, you can't tell, right? And that's why I preach community and like meeting other purely passive accredited investors, because that's where you figure out who is legit, who are the legit operators out there. But, you know, when I first started, I didn't know any accredited investors. I didn't have a rich uncle who did this stuff. And I was just putting in 50 grand here, 50 grand there, and kind of just going trial by fire. And I, you know, some people were shysters. Some people were, you know, totally incompetent. You know, met some good guys too, right? And that's kind of who I started to do more deals with. And, you know, at that same time, that was when the podcast got traction and people were like, hey, you know, originally you told us to buy, you know, rental real estate, right? Which I get it, for guys who are non-accredited under $500,000 net worth, that's the jam.
That's a great notice. I know a lot of successful people where that is a really powerful starting point.
But the comments, if I were to summarize, were like, hey, Lane, that's not what you're doing, you know? And this is kind of where I think the podcast started to change. And I kind of found my voice and my people who were mostly accredited investors, guys that make multiple six figures a year. Not necessarily the entrepreneur type, but, you know, maybe some were like 20% were successful business owners. But, you know, like the doctor that makes 600 grand a year who wants the tax benefits and looks for a place to invest it with, you know, honorable people. You know, I tell everybody, like, you know, in every investment, there's risk. But like, I think at least when I started, it's like, I want to invest with people who, you know, aren't going to steal my money. Right.
Certainly. And just, I guess, a few things that maybe just for anyone who's listening to the episode and maybe is not familiar with a couple of these terms, I just realized probably want to lay the basis of a few of these terms in case they're not familiar. First of all, accredited investors, you already mentioned this, $1 million net worth, or I think it's 3 years of 200,000 plus income. So it's a sustained high earning income or net worth over $1 million. Then you've got syndications. We're talking about, this is a vehicle you can invest in real estate through that aggregates funds and then invests on behalf of those investors, typically in larger investment deals, you know, more commercial real estate type things or multifamily, like large multi-unit type investments, right? And then trying to think if there's anything else that you touched on that we want to make sure that people understand, because I don't want to lose anybody on some of these terms.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you talk about leverage, there ain't nothing more nuclear leverage than syndications. And you can syndicate anything. I mean, We're actually even looking at, buying, old, doing some M&A on some professional services companies, right? Rolling those up, exactly what you mentioned earlier. And yeah, like this is kind of high level and oogity boogity, but like money is a multiplier,
yep.
a magnifier. It makes mean people meaner and generous people more generous. But it also, from a pragmatic standpoint, magnifies dreams and aspirations. And if you're a good CPA owner and you can rinse, wash, repeat your business skills, or if you're a good marketer and you can create good sales teams, syndication just turbocharges you with power and leverage.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge form of financial leverage. So this is something that I talk about at times on the podcast, and it's maybe good to review right now, which is most people start gaining leverage either through labor leverage or technological leverage. And that's because a lot of the most important financial leverage tools require a certain amount of net worth, either being an accredited investor or a certain amount of education. And often people don't prioritize the education until they have the money to work with. So it ends up most often that people start either building a business with labor leverage. One of the exceptions to this is real estate, and specifically rental real estate. It's a great way that you can actually use your first piece of leverage, can be financial leverage, to go get loans, because there's all these ways you can get loans for real estate that you wouldn't be able to get for anything else. And so you're using financial leverage to build wealth faster that way. And so even if it's rental properties, there's obviously different strategies and house hacking and all this stuff you can do to use real estate. But even that is often a form of labor leverage, because usually you either have to hire a property manager or manage people to go make that a reality. And so there's these base skills that are often people start with, like a service business or some form of labor leverage, add technological leverage, websites, marketing tools, write custom code, other things. And by the time they have a business that's producing money, then that third piece is like, all right, what do I do with this money? And the exception to that, like I said, you got real estate. The other exception would be people start in banking and in invest, hedge funds and all that. They go up through the finance world because they know finance is this massive source of leverage. But at the end of the day, there's a reason that most of the richest people in the world are proximate to the money. So the hedge fund owners, all that, that's the largest group of, billionaires and all that in the U.S. economy. They end up there because they're proximate to the money. And if you look at, if you were to roll up sort of real estate and finance as a group, you got a huge amount of people that are wildly wealthy because it is this huge lever that you can use. And so a syndication is just a much bigger lever than what you can get on a rental, especially if you own the syndication, are participating in the management of the syndication, where there's a large amount of money you can make within the management of the syndication in addition to the actual real estate investment. So there's sort of multiple layers of leverage to something like a syndication. And so it's a very common path that you see people go down, where first they're trying to figure out how to take their money, wield that financial leverage. Maybe they do that through rentals or through certain smaller things. And then graduating to that next level, something like a syndication or funds or other things, getting more proximate to larger amounts of money is going to just magnify those outcomes. Like you said, it's going to turbocharge them. Like you use nuclear, you can get much bigger outcomes that way.
Yeah. And this, I'm in a business mastermind group, Vistage. I think you had a revenue of $1 million or greater. But like one takeaway that came up is like, why do you keep growing and do bigger things? Well, to shut off the competition. So for those of you guys who own little rental properties, it's highly competitive. Everybody and their mother is unsophisticated rental property owner. Now, who are the people, buying these huge megaplexes? It's the institutional guys. They're also very smart. But there's a nice little sweet spot of people buying 100, 300, 400 unit apartment complexes, just in the multifamily world, right? There's a sweet spot. And if you're able to use just enough leverage to get you to that sweet spot, you kind of shut off a lot of the unsophisticated mom and pop investor leverage there. And it's just same concept, right? Whether you are a mechanic and you have two lifts in your facility and you want to get that fourth and fifth lift, now you're not competing with the small Johnny mechanic, right?
Yep. Yeah, it takes you to a totally different game. It's a great point. And we talk at my company a lot about this idea of the growth imperative. And it's really, there's several reasons that I see growth as an imperative. One is for personal fulfillment. I mean, good luck finding fulfillment in your life if you're not trying to grow in some way. So, I mean, that's it's a core element of finding fulfillment for people. And so you look at people that are born into massive wealth, super wealthy families, and end up on drugs and unhappy and all this stuff. It's hard to grow in that scenario. It's hard to find fulfillment. It's not everyone, but man, it's a massive percentage of those kids that get born in those situations that really struggle, right? And so you look at these patterns and you realize that money's not going to make you happy. It's not going to solve the fulfillment thing. But if you're fulfilled and you have money, that's certainly a good combination. So you got to hit both. So there's certainly from a fulfillment standpoint, it's an imperative. But the other imperative is it's what creates opportunity. So if I want to build a team and have people I care about, they're not going to want to make the same amount of money for the next 50 years. If most people don't. They're not going to want to have the same opportunity for the next 50 years. If I want to give them an exciting opportunity, if I want to give them a path for their life that's exciting, where there's growth, well, we all have to. And if they want to be able to build relationships with people that are going to be a part of their success, they're going to have to grow to create opportunities for them. And so any organization, anything, all the upside is in the growth. The fulfillment's in the growth, the opportunities in the growth. And so, yeah, I think it's a critical point that I just wanted to spend a little additional time on that you highlighted, that growth is an imperative. There's not a choice to just stay the same. That's just inching you closer to death, which is the alternative. You got growth pain, death pain, and you're either moving one direction or you experience the pain of the other.
I mean, that's one of Tony Robbins' six human needs is growth. I think in our community, one of the undertones though, and this kind of is counterintuitive to what we just said. Yes, growth is important and using debt and leverage is important to get to a certain point. But what is that certain point, right? Assuming the law of diminishing returns. And what I tell all my guys, just try and get to $4 to $5 million net worth. Because at that point, you can invest in traditional investments at 4 or 5% and, be making, 15,000-20,000 of passive income every single month. And at that point, you don't need to take on any leverage risk in there. If you want to, great, cool. Maybe do it with a smaller part of your portfolio. But, I think what I preach to my folks is let's safely get there as quickly as possible, but then let's go into cruise control. A lot of the strategies that I've kind of learned, that are $4, $5, $10 million net worth and above and emulating what more family offices do, it's from a high level looking at it, it does look like de-risking the situation.
I mean, that's a hugely important point. Ray Dalio, I think, was the one who said, don't fall in love with any one asset class because it'll drop 50 to 70% in a day. And it's true. When you look at his success, one of the smartest investors of all time, he talks about it through the lens of the game is managing risk. Managing risk is what creates all the growth. And so, when we talk about leverage, some people look at leverage and I think it's a shortcut. Like, oh, I'm going to go, I'm going to use margin on my crypto, or I'm going to do this. I'm going to get this bigger outcome. That's not what we're recommending, right? Finding ways, leverage in terms of skills, mindsets, these other things will be a long-term multiplier. And managing risk is a huge element of that, especially the larger your net worth gets, the more that risk management is the entire game, because you have so many opportunities to grow. And every bit you save of avoiding and de-risking becomes a compounding growth factor. So that's a huge element. So I love that you pointed that out. We're definitely not advocating. No one should listen to this podcast and think, oh, I just need to go get more, take on as much risk. That's not the point of what we're saying here. And I love the way that you frame that, because it's de-risking is massive leverage in and of itself.
I mean, don't get me wrong, right? I'm almost 40 and I'm not looking to go do nothing. So I'm still in it. Although I sometimes ask myself why, but I think this is the idea of a lot of people that are getting started, you're in this hustle culture, hustle mindset. And I think that's great. I was there at one time, but I truly believe in there's not one flip the light switch type of moment, but if you're able to somehow transition smoothly from hustle culture to enjoying life, trading money and time for experiences. People have read the book by Bill Perkins. He was on my podcast, Die With Zero, this concept of, not literally dying with zero money and blowing all your cash, but life is a game of maximizing the amount of experiences and memories that you have. And what good is the money at the end?
Yeah. I think it's important also to make that distinction. When we're talking about growth, it's not just about growing your net worth, growing money. You got to grow as a person. That's where the fulfillment is at. That's what I mean. If you're not growing relationships, if you're not growing in the experiences you're having, your life's not going to be fulfilling. I know plenty of people who have lots of money and are very unhappy. And you say that to people, and people who don't have a lot of money don't think that's possible. They're like, no, wait, because all my problems right now are based on money. Well, that's fine. But once those are gone, there's going to be other problems. And often the unfortunate part is those problems are a little bit more difficult to wrestle with emotionally. So, money is a problem that can be easily wrestled with. I need more money. I work hard to go get more money. But once there isn't that issue, an example I love to give to people is like, you don't have to make decisions on things that are outside the realm of possibility. So if I only make $50,000 a year and I know the best car I can afford, let's just say even if I wanted to really blow it was like, I don't know, a $30,000 car. When I get served ads mistakenly for $100,000 cars, $200,000 cars, $500,000 cars, my brain doesn't even start to process, should I buy that or not? I don't even start down the evaluation because it's not even possible. I don't wonder, should I spend money on this mansion? I don't wonder, should I start this new business? It's not an option for me. And so if it's not an option, I don't spend any time stressing about it. And then the more you accumulate wealth, the more everything's an option. The cars are an option. The houses are an option. The consumerism is an option. Every vice or problem you could have is an option. So if you're not happy with who you are, you're not finding that fulfillment, you're not finding the growth, then money just, like you said, it's an amplifier that just makes all those things worse. So now you have tons of money and you're even less fulfilled, you're even less happy, and nothing's ever enough. And so, yeah, I think that's such an important distinction. Growth is not about more money. You may end up with more money. A lot of the best people I know end up very successful financially because, building your character can result in huge financial growth. But if you do one at the expense of the other, you're going to be miserable. I think that's such a great point.
I will say, we essentially help people get the financial freedom and then, quit their day jobs. And it seems kind of obvious, right? You're going to get more money, work on yourself, figure out your quirks, right? Because, your more money is just going to magnify your quirks. But it's hard. When you're working and you're busy building your business and you're, working your day job, you just don't have the mind space to kind of work on some of these things it's not like we go on 7-day silent meditation retreats, right? Which may be the prescription for this. But what I've realized or observing from some of our clients that pull the pin, they got enough money to quit and they do that and they kind of go on the sabbatical in a way, that's when they really kind of start to work on some of the stuff. But you got busy, you got kids, you got work. You're not going to find it, it's just hard. It's not that you're not emotionally mature or anything. You're just freaking busy,
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. And I know for me, the most common example I see, a lot of my friends, I'm very much in the sort of entrepreneurship side. And so a lot of my friends have sold companies for large sums of money. You talk to them and you look, more importantly, watch them. And there's this pattern of 3 to 6 months, they go out and enjoy their life. They go on cool experiences. They spend time with their family. It's kind of making up for lost time, finding themselves again. And then they just start itching and they're like, I got to go build another business. I got to go do something else. I want to solve a problem. I want to find this meaning. Or they get really depressed, sometimes both. And it's just people, think, oh, if I sold a company for $30 million, I would never be depressed. I could never be depressed. Yeah. And yet I see it. I see it in people that I know and care about who have these big exits, turn around, and then they got to get back to work because that feeling, that need for purpose is in all of us. You have to find that. It's not to say work's the only way to find it, but there's no substitute for that personal. There's no amount of money that replaces that for sure.
Yeah. That's just kind of like myself and my business, right? We own $2 billion of assets and I like that feeling. I mean, for what it is, it's an ego thing. I mean, to me, I like it because we kind of get people, we bring people along on their financial journeys. And I'll call it out. It's an ego thing. Damn it, it is. But how many people out there that own something like that, or even know what gets them wired up and motivated and gives them internal gratitude? Now, this may change for me as I age into my 40s and 50s. That's how life is, right? You change. And what I'm kind of learning is you go through quadrants of your life. So this does change. But you know, like to me, like I think it's this concept of like hitting resonance frequency, like, you know, like the Phillips toothbrush or the tuning fork, right? You hit it at a certain point and it just high speed, low drag. And like, this is what I kind of enjoy, right? Like I don't really go on long vacations. If not, I get antsy. I need to be on the computer doing what I do. And maybe that will lead to a life of unhappiness and constant working. But like, I also hear it from the other side. Like I said, right? Like, own it. That's just how you're wired up, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that. So you brought up Tony Robbins before. I'm a huge fan of Tony Robbins. I go to a bunch of his events. I'm part of his Platinum Partnership group. I do a ton of stuff with him. And just, I love what he teaches. But you brought up these six human needs. That's a huge element. Is this concept of, we all have these human needs we're trying to fill, and that's not going away. So it's like, if owning a certain business or having a portfolio or assets under management, if that checks a box for needing to feel significant, and, you know, like you said, feed the ego, it's not necessarily bad. If you're doing it at other people's expense, hurting people, whatever, then obviously that's a different thing. But there's plenty of healthy ways that it's in all of us to want to achieve something and feel that significance. It's in all of us to want to create some certainty for our financial future, that financial freedom. We also, though, want that variety, like the experiences you talked about. We also want the love and connection that comes with relationships, intimate relationships, close relationships, and then the growth and the contribution, contributing to something bigger than ourselves and seeing ourselves and others grow. I mean, all those are things that fill, make life meaningful, and we're in charge of that. We have to make it meaningful, and that doesn't go away with that. That growth is actually totally decoupled from money. Almost totally, because some of those things, like, for example, certainty and ego, money does serve some of those to some extent, but you'll find plenty of examples of people with little money who are meeting all their human needs and love their life. You'll find plenty of people with tons of money who aren't meeting any of their needs or meeting very few needs or meeting them in an unhealthy way and are really miserable in their life. And so to me, that's a really empowering thing, is to look at that and go, wherever you're at in the journey, they don't have to be correlated. I can be really happy and live a fulfilled life, no matter if I'm at the basement floor just starting, if I'm part of the way through my financial journey, if I've got a really high net worth and I'm you know, in the top few percentile or fraction of a percentile, wherever I'm at, I can be living a meaningful life. Is that something you've seen and experienced? Tell me about, you mentioned this, and I relate with it. I had an experience just last year where I think there's certain points that everyone gets to where maybe you hit a new goal or a milestone or something you thought would take longer to achieve. And you kind of go, why am I doing this? Like, should I be doing this? Like, because you maybe had purpose or you had some identity. For me, I had some identity in certain goals I wanted to achieve. And here I am, 33, and they were achieved already. And I was like, oh, well, then what am I doing? I had a plan. I had a thing I was going for. That's already done. Well, what's next? And so I had to rebuild that vision of my future. I had to rebuild some of these things to work on myself, like you said. What was that like for you? Or did you have a similar experience?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like myself, I'm not like a born entrepreneur, right? Like I'm kind of a transplant coming from the linear path, go to school, study hard, go to job. I mean, a freaking engineer job for you know, like, I mean, you can't get any more like, you know, straight line than that. But what I've noticed for myself, and it's easier to notice in other people, right? Like my clients, is like this movement from scarcity to abundance, right? Like if you notice what, you know, my story, what in initial, like I would just try and save money. You know, I wouldn't go out with my friends sometimes. I'd save money, just be that cheapo guy, right? Like, and those guys are never fun. They're not about other people. They might be great people, right? But what I enjoy is like, you know, when people start to have $5,000, $10,000 of passive income a month from their investments and then, you know, cutting their tax bill in half, they tend to change to more of an abundance mindset because that pressure is off a little bit. Yeah. Now, money's not everything, but it's kind of important, I think, in the first half of your life when you don't have it. And so at least that's what I've noticed from myself is like, you know, you plug the six human needs from Tony Robbins. There's a point, yeah, you're trying to achieve those needs, but there's also another undertone of at some point it's more for other people achieving said needs in combo. And for me, it's very easy to see it in my clients, right? Like you get a guy who's super like, you know, we have like a mastermind group and they're always looking for strategies and people to invest with. And so, you know, the new guys, they come in, they ask all these questions, like, who's your CPA? You know, who's your tax attorney? And, you know, what did you invest in this deal, this deal, this deal? And I get it where it's coming from. It's coming from scarcity, right? You're afraid. You don't know what you're doing. But the people who've been in the community for a long time and kind of gotten a level, they see the light at the end of the tunnel, right? They switch from, they're transitioning from scarcity to abundance. They realize that, you know, it's more about helping each other. And it's, you know, I always tell my folks, like, the currency of the wealthy are social relationships, you know, because it's pretty easy for us to get you to 4 or 5 mil net worth. You follow the plan, you're there. But what you can't, what's kind of hard is, like, you can get there being a jerk and doing it all yourself and nobody's your friend other than your spouse, who may not like you anyway either.
Yeah, in some cases.
Or having a community of people that went on this journey with you that are somewhat comrades, you know, you didn't go to war with. I mean, it's the furthest thing from war, but in a way, you know, it's shared experiences, shared struggles, and that creates a very rich life, I think. And what I realize, it's like, it's not, because I was there myself, right? Like, I was like atypical, like I'd like do all kinds of cheap little things to save my money, you know, go to like, now, what would I do? I would like take a shower at work to save like $5, you know, not having to use the hot water at home. I'd like use the restroom at work as much as I could, you know, like, things like that. Just ridiculous thing. I would never pick up the tab at the bar for my, you know, buddies or people I kind of knew, right? Like, I was not that guy. But slowly, I think things change. Sure, you know, I think that's also what, you know, models and role models for myself have kind of done for myself, right? Having that freedom, the abundance. But then again, it's easy to have that mindset when month after month, you got 10 G's dropping in your bank account because of your investment too.
Sure. Yeah, man. That's a big element of, I think, something that we have touched on here is this concept of there's different goals for different points, but most people should have some form of goal of getting to this point where their investments can provide for them, you know, can cover their costs, can become a vehicle that can pay, whether or not you actually choose to operation. Like for me, for example, I don't live on any of my investment income right now. I've been just reinvest all of it. You know, I'm much more focused on growing and I have plenty of money and I live a pretty chill life and I don't need it. But it knowing that I could switch to using that or rebalance my portfolio towards cash flow heavy investments or towards things that would pay out, you know, in the short term, that's a very powerful place to be. Because you know that there's always sort of that backup plan. There's something in place there that you can rely on. And that is such a mindset shift, especially if you've never experienced that. And so I think that a lot of people don't even realize that's possible and certainly maybe think that that's like a retirement only thing. That's something I could do when I retire. You know, it's 65 or whatever the predetermined age ends up being for that generation. That's when I get to start like having money come to me. The reality is if you're more effective about building wealth and you build it earlier and you build it in the right vehicles, you can do that sooner. What are some things you've seen with people that has helped them take that, make that shift from income from investments as a future retirement type thing to something that might be a sooner term goal? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the fundamental mind shift things that we teach in our seminars is, This is why things are kind of backwards. Like we're all taught to kind of build up your savings and assets into this big pile, get to 60 plus years old when you can't even enjoy the damn thing, and then start eating at the pile, right? Or living off the dividends off of that. In reality, if you look what the wealthy do is they start to build mini pensions. Or the way I started, like I would just buy, you know, like when I first started, 11 rental properties. So there was like mini pensions and each rental property gave me a few $100 of cash flow every month. And then it expanded, right? A lot of accredited investors might have dozens and dozens of, you know, private placement syndications, which representative of like these mini pensions. And you have multiple streams of income, right? People have heard this before, right? But if you're kind of building one and you build the other and you don't have to eat from it, exactly kind of what you mentioned earlier, it could be feeding to creating more mini pension babies. And at some point, when the when the collective stream of income from all of these reaches a certain point, you have a, you know, good problem on your hands. But that's, you know, that's the kind of what we kind of preach in a way. I mean, and this is kind of like, you know, like I think what gets me going, like I see myself a little bit of a Robin Hood, steal from the rich, give to, maybe not necessarily give to the poor, but give to the people who are kind of in the middle there, able to get out the beaten path and, you know, invest in alternative investments, because people are getting screwed with all these retail stock market investments and they don't even know it. I mean, that's, I mean, look at my parents. They invested in that stuff their entire lives and they barely got them anywhere. And yeah, you know, I get it. That's how Wall Street works. Wall Street, you know, how else do they have these large, big buildings? Goes to all the CEOs in the building, you know, all the profits go to them. Mm-hmm. And the investors takes on all the risk and barely gets anything, where, you know, part of what we do is we invest directly with the operators and we cut out all these middlemen, all these salesmen. Don't get me started on financial planners. You know, they're just glorified salesmen. And, yep. And kind of, you know, instead of investing in Wall Street, invest straight on Main Street is kind of the idea.
One tactic that I encourage people to use, because I've seen this in almost every investment type, right? I think one of the fundamental skills that is lacking in financial literacy at every level of the house, if you will, is an understanding of fee structures. And one hack that people can take is, in any investment of any kind, you can take the documents provided to you, put them in ChatGPT, and tell ChatGPT to read them and say, I want you to find me anywhere in this document that there is a explicit fee, an implicit fee, or anything that resembles a fee or cost that would come out of my money. And I want you to provide that all back to me. And what you find is that most people think they know their fees and they don't. So in certain, you know, 401ks or mutual funds, they might think that there's an advertised like, oh, we're a low rate fee type thing. But there's a 1% fee when it goes in. There's a 2% fee when it comes out. There's all these transaction fees. There's, you know, this other hidden fee. There's the fee that they're charging is the custodian's not the same as the fee that the fund's charging. They're holding.
Let me spend $500,000 on this little dinner party and hide it above the line as an expense marketing.
Yep. Yeah. So there's a lot of things like that people aren't aware of. And there's a great hack. That's a hack for anyone to take and use. Put it all in there. Now, obviously, the documents have to represent the fees. That's not a foolproof solution, because not all fees are sort of documented. And this is where you're getting to, especially when you get into other types of investments. You know, let's say you work with some sort of financial advisor, and they also sell you funds that they own. If you don't know how to ask them, so some of the things you can do, again, tactics here, you can ask them, I want you to disclose and sign a document telling me you've disclosed every income stream you have on my money. So I want to know every income stream that you get from my money, including fees I pay you directly, fees you take on funds that you sell me, fees on referral fees from products you sell me, et cetera. There's all these different ways that they might be making money on my money. And any good financial planner, anybody who's actually working with your best interest in mind, which is a very small group of people that are truly fiduciaries. So those people, first of all, are not ashamed to show you how they make their money. And second of all, I don't mind them making a bunch of money on me if they're doing a good service. But most people have no idea, one, how much money they're paying, and no concept of figuring out, am I getting value on that? So the other thing is, for investments you may not understand, or where there may not be regulatory requirements to understand all the fee structures, I would get a written contract where they swear to the fact that they've disclosed it all to you, and they list that in the contract, because now you can take that. And if at some point you find out they've been charging another fee, you can go sue them and recapture that. So, you know, obviously that's a higher cost thing. If you don't have money to sue somebody, that's a different thing. But the point is, there are ways, if you just know to ask that, and frankly, you'll find out real quick. If you ask an advisor or one of these people, a salesman of some product or whatever, they're going to get real uncomfortable when you ask that question, if it's not obvious in the first place. And then once they've disclosed them all, you can go run the math on it. What you find is there's many layers of fee structures to every investment vehicle. So one of the reasons that I actually love, for people on that bottom floor, direct real estate investment as a starting point, is because the amount of gains you get that cut out all the fees for people who have such little money to work with, that has this massive compounding effect on their life. And it's the same thing with the stock market. If you're investing in stocks and you're not, you've got to do it direct into index funds that have minimal fees. You got to be sure you understand all the fee structure. that's going to work. It's, I mean, the smartest people in the world recommend it. If you're going to be in equities, do it through these index funds. Warren Buffett says it. Ray Dalio says it. These guys don't have anything to gain from you doing that. There's reasons for this. There are some very minimal fee options in any given asset class. And that's where, especially if you don't have a lot of wealth, you have to play in those areas because it will make 40, 50% difference over time. It will compound so significantly. And so anyways, just a few more tactics I've seen. Happy if you want to riff on that at all or share any things you've seen where that fee structure can really hurt, especially people early on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, unfortunately, like if people don't have very much money, you're kind of stuck in their clutches, right? I mean, to get into alternative investments with reputable operators, if you're not dropping a $50,000, $100,000 check, to be honest, you don't belong playing in the game. I mean, that's why they allow only accredited investors to do it. And I think that's a little messed up, but unfortunately, that's how the world works. But yeah, I mean, people in our ecosystem, even some of the lower net worth people, they don't really use those financial planners. You know, they'll just use ETFs or index funds. But, you know, I mean, yeah, like it's kind of one of those shams out there. And again, yeah, you know, if you sense it to me, it's been a source of frustration for myself. And I wish that they would kind of teach this in schools. Like, you don't have to invest $100,000 in a syndication. Just start off with a little rental property.
Yeah.
$100,000, put 20% down payment. And, you know, that $20,000 down payment may take you several years to save up, but now you're moving on the elevator, the escalator of building wealth. And as soon as you know it, you'll have two rental properties. And that's just, and again, that's how I kind of started from nothing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's, I think it's worth pointing out just that at that lowest level, when you're first starting out, there's a lot of things where this is one of those areas where I said there's different rules at different levels. Everyone I know that has 8-9 figure net worth is paying someone to manage their money, but they are not paying for no offense to any particular, in fact, I'm not going to say any companies, I don't want to get in trouble, but a mainstream brand, certified financial, whatever the hell, who's taking 1% of everything in and all sorts of different fees on top of that. They're not selling you products. They're not. So when you're paying for someone's services in this space, that's a different rule at a certain level, because at that level, they're going to be doing things for you that no one at the lower level does. And so you might look at that and go, oh, well, anyone who has a massive net worth tends to have either their own family office, be part of a multifamily office, pay fees for that. Okay, but what you don't know is that they're also getting for that price that they're paying, which they know the exact price they're paying, access to private investments, which are historically outpaced public investments across the board, private debt, private equity, et cetera, outpace public investments. So again, as long as they choose the right person and they get access to the right funds, that can be a really smart choice. They're getting tax loss harvesting. So the fee in and of itself will pay for itself just through tax loss harvesting, which no one's going to do for you I've got $100,000 in my investment account and I have a financial planner. They're not doing that. And if they are doing it, they're using an automated system. So like even Vanguard sells, I think, a 0.3% fee, tax loss harvester. So you can do that and have it fully be automated. And you're actually getting that benefit. So, but again, once your portfolio has to be as a certain size for that to even start to make sense, because you can't properly run that strategy without being able to direct own the basket of products you need to own. So there's all these things that if you try to model the people that are ultra rich, I mean, someone with $100 million plus net worth has a staff of people that work for them to manage their money. You should not have a staff of people that work for you to manage your money. Like, so it's clear when you break it down, these are not the same thing. But one of the things I hate is seeing people that will use that as a marketing tactic. Well, this is what the ultra rich do. They have financial planners. It's like, okay, well, let's be realistic here. Different phases.
If you don't mind, Spencer, I'd like to plug my book. We have a chart in there.
Please.
You go look where your net worth is based on what floor you're at. Here's the tax strategies, the investment strategies, the personal banking, infinite banking strategies you should follow for starters. Look, I'm not the guy. If you're under $250,000 net worth and you make less than $60,000, I'm not the guy to listen to. But if you make a good salary and you're a credit investor, certainly, you know, maybe check out the Wealth Elevator, you know, sold on Amazon, and I would say start there.
Yeah. My personal favorite is probably I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. I think he's got a great book for absolute people who have no idea and are just at that bottom floor of saying, I need some guidance about how to get educated on my personal finance. He's got some absolute great materials. I even like Dave Ramsey for people, especially if you struggle with that, if you really have an unhealthy relationship with debt. I love Dave Ramsey as a starting point. So starting somewhere like that and getting through that first level, I mean, you got to get someone to help open your eyes to, I need to make more money. I got to control my costs and be smart about how I spend my money. Like, there are some basic financial basics that those people are going to be for you. And that'll give you a gap. That'll give you savings or available funds. And then what you do with that is going to make a much bigger difference in the long-term strategy. Do I climb the ladder or do I just stay stuck here because I take all that money, I spend it on liabilities, I spend it on consumerism? You're going to be there forever. If you take that money and you say, I'm going to hold on to it, I'm going to try to make educated decisions with it, I'm going to invest it, I'm going to start to, maybe it's a rental property, maybe it's other investments, but I'm going to make this money work for me so that I can get it to grow. Well, now 5 to 10 years down the line, maybe they get lucky and they find themselves in your shoes, Lane, and they walk away from their corporate job and they're able to really take off on their own journey. Well, sounds like you're pretty clear about kind of the people you work with and who you help. So if someone, maybe just recap that for us. Who are the people that should go pursue your book or visit your websites, and what are those locations for you?
Yeah, I would say, like, if your income is over 100 grand and or certainly you're a credit investor, I would say the strategies that we kind of specialize in, they would be very pertinent to where you're growing into. Also, I got my podcast that I've been working on since 2016, The Wealth Elevator. We can search for that. And then, yeah, if anybody's an accredited investor out there, feel free to reach out, lane@thewealthelevator.com.
Awesome, Lane. We really appreciate the insights. Appreciate the great conversation. Thanks for joining us today.
Go ahead.
Hey, before you go, I have a small request. Our mission is to empower as many people as possible to maximize their potential through the power of leverage. Could you help us in this mission by leaving a review on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube? And if you know just one person who would benefit from today's episode, would you please share it with them? Your support means the world to us, and we are thrilled to have you in the community. Thank you for being a part of our journey and helping us grow. You can find show notes for today's show and past shows at lessonsinleverage.com, which also has links to connect with me personally and connect with our various podcast channels across your favorite social networks. A big thanks to Solve.cloud, who sponsored this episode. They're a group of expert consultants that help SaaS and financial services companies to implement, optimize, and manage Salesforce.com. They can help you with custom integration solutions and are helping customers to implement some of the most important generative AI technologies. You can find them at Solve.cloud. That's SOLVD.cloud is the URL. Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.